Blog Talk Radio.
Radio in a very special edition of Poetry Superhighway Live. I am sitting here with the fantastically wonderful Rick Lupert. We're actually not sitting together. We're sitting in separate locations tied by a phone line. And in fact, I'm quite shoeless and pantless right now. Rick.
Yes.
What America doesn't know is, well, first of all, I'm very honored to be talking to you about your wonderful new book. And what America doesn't know is that you ran pretty much a major contest for people to actually sit here and be honored talking to you. And a lot of celebrities, you know, came into that contest. I remember you had Morgan Freeman in Nevada fondue wrestling a Choctaw hog, and of course me and Ian McKellen were the finalists, and you had us eat tamales, vegetarian spicy tamales, and Ian came close. He had 19 tamales, I had 20. I felt pretty sick of, you know, afterwards, but it was all worth it just to be here talking to you right now and in your face, Ian McKellen. So let's talk about your brand new book, a 200-page opus. What I love about your, what I call your travelogue books, is that not many people, Robert Wynn comes to mind, can actually go on trips and write about those trips. So you're not just writing poetry, you're not just writing humor about those trips. You're also including history. You're including your emotional reactions to what you find. And one of the characters in your, well, it's become a character in your writing of these travelogues is your wife, Addie, and it's always wonderful to see that. What initially inspired you to say, you know, hey, I'm traveling to Paris. I think I'll write a travelogue poetry book.
Well, that's a good question. First of all, thanks for having this conversation with me. It's the honor is truly mine. I'd forgotten about the fondue aspect. It wasn't more of so much of a contest as just I like fondue a lot, and that seemed like that was a way to have a lot of it at once.
Oh, Morgan had a great time with that.
I'm sure. So the book is called, by the way, Nothing in New England is New. It's all poems written in on a trip to New England last summer. And you're right, it is a travelogue book, and a lot of my books take that format. They're written over a short period of time on these trips. So my first one, as you alluded to, it was Paris, It's the Cheese, which came out in 1996, I think, and it was a much shorter book. In terms of what inspired me to write, you know, I didn't know at the time that I was writing a book. You know, of course, at that point, I'd been identifying myself as a poet and involved with poetry in L.A. at least a few years at that point. And so naturally, I was in a situation, a new situation, and poetry started happening. I mean, you know, I find that I write a lot more when I'm outside of my normal element, when I'm not, going through the everyday
mundane
details of working and taking my kid to preschool and all that. So here I am in Paris, which was you know, such an incredible dream to get to the first time. It's really the first place that I traveled to that I really wanted to go to, you know, and my eyes were wide open to what I was seeing and what was going on, and poetry came out. And by the end of the trip, you know, I had, it occurred to me, wow, I have like enough for a little chapbook, so why not put it out?
So Paris was initially the first location that inspired you.
In terms of this kind
to
of travel
do, to
poetry,
do that.
Yeah. Sure, yeah.
Yeah, and in fact, the first edition copy of that book, for the lucky few, they also got a cassette tape of some of your adventures in Paris, which were absolutely hilarious.
Thanks. To clarify, there was no second edition.
But, oh, there was no second edition. Wow, then I really am lucky then.
That's the only book I haven't brought back into print from those early books.
I didn't know that.
But maybe that'll happen someday.
It's a great book. It's a great book, and I treasure my little cassette tape. Yes, I still have my cassette tape of that. And want to get to your poetry in just a moment, but I do want to point out that when you do these travelogues, you don't just start at the cities. You have a journey you make with these books, which usually begins at the airport. And I would like you to read from page 10, I've Been to Madison, I believe it's called, to give us a start kind of on the journey that we're going to take with this book.
Sure. This is called I've Been to Madison, Wisconsin. I've been in 4 airports today, one more than I thought, and the final one not the one I intended. I can finally say I've been to Madison, Wisconsin. I can finally tell Newark, surprise! There was the added benefit of the extra couple of hours in Chicago. O'Hare and I never get to spend much time together, so that was nice. I understand my luggage will be going to Philadelphia. Good for it. It's a wonderful city, rich in history and brotherly love. I hope it gets to see the Liberty Bell. Maybe get a Philly cheesesteak. It's not a vegetarian like us.
You are one of the few people that can take the mundane and just throw it completely in a new direction where you almost get an insight into things that you wouldn't think there would be insights to, like airport restrooms and Burger King at airports and, you know, the flights. And of course, once you get to your destination, then you have a lot of really great insights. On page 14, I would like you, it's a very short poem, I would like you to read the title of your book, the title poem of your book.
Sure. Should I do that right now?
Yeah.
All right. It's called Nothing in New England is New. We're looking forward to traveling through New England, though I'm not sure how new it is, as every attraction in the guidebook is described as old. You know, I think you're right about this whole idea of taking, you know, drawing attention to the mundane. I mean, that's sort of my style in general. And I was thinking about it during that first poem that you had me read. It's, you know, we actually didn't get our luggage right away, you know, and it wasn't the first time. Well, yeah, it wasn't the first time, nor was it the last time that happened, as I recall, because later we went to England over winter break and didn't have our luggage for like 3 days. It was awful, which, you know, back to this trip, we stopped in Allentown for a few days where we were dropping off our son so we could go on this trip through New England. And, you know, it didn't feel mundane that we didn't have our luggage. It felt like, you know, a big deal. And so much of the time was spent, you know, talking with people on the airlines and figuring, well, why did this bag go to that airport and why did this one go to that airport? And, well, I guess if it's a problem, you could deliver this one to our first hotel in this place. And, you know, it was like, it was the consuming you know, thing of the first, you know, 2 days of this trip before we actually got on the trip part of the trip per se. So, but maybe there's something, you know, maybe losing your luggage is a mundane thing anyway, and all of that was showing the spectacle in it.
Well, certainly to when it's happening to you, it's not going to be mundane. But a poet that didn't have the skill that you have and didn't have the humor that you had could make that, you know, pretty mundane. And you take it and you find the humor in it, and in that it becomes relatable to everyone. You know, even if we haven't lost our luggage, we certainly have heard of people losing their luggage. You know, and when we hear that, it's like, oh, yeah, you know, that we kind of expect it from airports. But you take it and you freshen the perspective and give it a little humor. And I love that about you. I love that you can do that. It's not an easy skill. It's something that we kind of take for granted. And you are one of the few authors that not only do I have, I think, every book you've ever written, but that I can come into the book completely knowing that I'm going to enjoy this book. There's, you know, you can never suck. You know, you're a friend
of mine.
James,
I've received a number of emails specifically pointing out all the ways in which I suck. So I, you know,
yeah, well,
but
I'm
glad you like it. Thank you.
Well, I have better taste than most people, so I'm told. But a friend once said about another wonderful poet, Paul Suntup, that he's infallible. Well, you are also infallible. Let's move on to another poem that I really enjoyed, and it's called Odalisques. Am I pronouncing that correctly? For John Grillo. That's on page 38.
Page 38. Okay, yeah, this was written in the Springfield Museums, which, you know, a lot of our time on these trips, besides wandering around the cities and seeing what there is to see, is being in museums and writing what I like to think of as sort of little ekphrastic observations. Ekphrastic, you know, being, you know, artwork inspired by other works of art. And this is another one in which, of course, Addie plays, you know, is a character, as you mentioned earlier.
I love her appearances in these pieces.
Well, I kind of joked, you know, at least a couple of books ago, and maybe somewhere in this book, that she should probably get an author's credit, because, you know, a lot of these little observations, I'm sort of taking something that she said, which I thought was funny, you know, or interesting,
yeah,
or offbeat, and putting it in this little poem context. So I'm at least giving her half the money, I should tell you that.
Well, she at least in this book, she often mishears words, so they're funnier. And then it inspires you to write a poem about that. And I you know, it probably helps that I know Addie, I know, you know, how she looks like, and so I can actually picture it. But I think that she adds a flavor to your work. So anyways, yeah. So let's get to this poem.
All right, it's called Four Odalisques, which is the title of the painting by John Grillo. Addie delights in pointing out the painting of naked women with cats. She knows what I like.
It's a nice little short piece, but there's so much flavor to it. And it kind of gives, without saying too much, you know, it gives a lot of information, you know. We know you like cats.
Well, poetry is about saying, you know, as much as you can with as few words as possible, as far as I'm concerned.
And you do it very well. You know, you don't have huge, huge poems. Some of them are slightly larger than others. Some of them are super teeny tiny. In your trips, you also mix a lot of history. You mix the local color. You're like a documentarian in some of these poems, where you're taking, again, something that might be kind of dry and dull, you know, when you're hearing my, you know, it's a history lesson, but again, through your sense of humor and your insight, you have a lot of very perceptive insights when it comes to the history of a location. Do you consider yourself a history buff at all, or a historian at all?
That's interesting. I'd never really thought that these like little poems written in historical places necessarily provided too much insight. So it's interesting to hear you say that. In terms of being a history buff, I think it's I don't know how else to say this, but I think it's really cool to be in places where things happened. You know, and I know that sounds silly to say it that way, but I just think it's the coolest thing in the world. I was actually looking on the there was a news item today on Yahoo about a river boat or a ferry or something that sunk or caught on fire and a bunch of people died in the San Francisco area in like the 1800s, and they just now, you know, this within the last couple of weeks, put up a monument to it and it
wow.
You know, made it that suddenly this story is alive again, and there were relatives or descendants of some of these people, and cases where entire families, or at least one case where entire family was on this boat and died. And so it's history is fascinating. And being in the places where these things happen, make it so real, you know, walking around Boston and being at the Old North Church, you know, where they lit the, you know, one if by land, two if by sea. Well, there it was, you know, that was where they lit those, you know, right at the top of that. And and there's places like that all over, like in the book, you know, I'm sure you're getting to this, but, you know, we get to Plymouth and actually see Plymouth Rock, and, you know, and we went to Salem, and there was, you know, where all of this stuff with the witch trials happened, and it's just amazing to be in those actual places. I'm fascinated by it.
I was going to save that one for a little later, but since you did bring up the Salem, that is precisely one of the pieces that I saw or read where I kind of went, wow. Here he takes something that is wholly serious, very much ingrained in, you know, anybody with any sense of intelligence or sense of history, and you come up with a fresh point of view on it, a little bit of humor, but also there is definitely a very serious subtext to it, and it's called Searching for Witches. It's on page 78. And since we are talking about that, why don't you read that one right now?
Sure. Yeah. You know, what was – well, you know what? The poem kind of gives it all away. So let me just read it, and then if I talk about it if you want. It begins with a quote from someone who actually was there at the time from 1693 named Increase Mathers was his name. And they said –
which, by the way, I saw that and I was like, oh, my God. What a name.
I know.
Like, you could not have created a more goofy name than Increase Mathers.
I bet you could if you tried.
Well, if they had, you know, porn films back then, that would have been a perfect name.
Maybe. So Increase Mathers said, "It were better that 10 suspected witches should escape than the innocent person should be condemned. A thick red line takes us to all the hot spots, the fake museums, the old well, the cemeteries, with crypts collapsing. A human guide tells us how it is. She tells us what it means to be pressed. They lay you on the ground, a board on top of you, a stone placed on the board. If you didn't confess, they'd put on another stone until you were dead, pressed. We sit near the marker for Sarah Wilds, hanged July 19th, 1692. It took until 1992 for the town of Salem to make a memorial to their witches. On Halloween, our guide tells us it's like Mardi Gras here. Some Wiccans come to the memorial, bow down to the ground, and claim they feel the energy of their ancestors. Our guide wants to tell them they weren't witches. They miss the point of the memorial. It is not a celebration of the occult. It is how Germany felt after World War II. It is an embarrassment.
That last line is just such a killer line. And again, it brings back the insight I was talking about, and it connects with what we were talking about previously, where you brought up the ferry boat incident and how there wasn't a memorial until just recently. Well, in this poem, there wasn't a memorial till recently as well. The detail, you know, again, you're making something that could have been so dry, but by bringing in the very vivid details, you make it real for the reader. You make it vivid for the reader. And that's certainly one of your more serious pieces in the book. I really loved it. When I first read it, I said, oh, I got to get him to read this one.
So you did. Yes, Salem was a really interesting town. I don't know, you know, if anyone listening has had the chance to go there. But, you know, it's really about this horrible thing that happened. And and when you get to the town, there's all kinds of crazy things that are there that have to do with the occult and witchcraft, but nothing to do with the actual events. You know, it's like being in a permanent, you know, there's haunted houses and witch museums and things like that that don't tell the story, which had nothing really to do with witchcraft, just of people, you know. And it's so it's kind of weird and sad to be there at that same time. And our guide, I remember, told us that, you know, they really found the whole thing embarrassing for hundreds of years, and that's why they didn't have a memorial up. You know, they just didn't want to be known for that. You know, and of course everyone knows it because you study it in history and in high school and before and that kind of thing. And they you know, it was actually because they, you know, they realized they could do a brisk tourist business if they kind of celebrated it a bit more. And celebrate is a weird word to say, but with all the stuff that's there, it almost is a celebration, you know. But the fact that they actually put up a memorial in 1992, relatively recently compared to when it all went down, was, you know, it kind of shows that, well, okay, I guess they really do take this seriously at a certain point. So it was a very strange place to be.
Yeah, it sounds to me like they're making a trade-off. They need the tourist business, so they're catering to the entertainment, you know, and the fantasy of the thing. But at the same time, like you said, they're probably, a lot of them, very, very secretly embarrassed and maybe even mortified that they have to do what they have to do. And of course, the tourists, you know, they don't understand. They don't get the full picture, and it is an entertainment to them. And it's, you know, Salem,
not every tourist. I mean, it's certainly not us. And there
not
are
all of the tourists.
There are.
We shouldn't say all of the tourists. We don't want the, you know, we don't want to start getting angry calls from tourists.
That's right. If we don't.
Don't call us tourists. Enough of that silliness. But of course, it's not all serious in the book, and you have a great mixture, a great balance of the serious and the levity, which you are, you know, infamous for. Addie plays a great part in that levity. What would you say would be the biggest change that has happened in your poetry because Addy came into your life?
Well, you know, suddenly I had a muse, you know. I had someone to bounce ideas off of and to say, you know, the funny things or, you know, the things that I thought might be funny out loud and maybe get a reaction. And then she's just really funny on her own. I mean, and just the way that she sees things and, you know, looks at a painting and sees, you know, a particular detail, which, you know, or interprets a detail in one way, which is hilarious, you know, or she has a way of completely, you know, I might say something which I think is grand and big, and she'll, you know, sort of put it all in its place with one witty comment, you know, and it's you know, a lot of the work, especially this, well, really a lot of the travel work, though there's a bunch of standalone poems from her from throughout the, you know, the time that I've known her, you know, if the books are really about my experiences in these places, you know, a lot of my experience is defined by who I'm traveling with, and that's
absolutely
my beloved wife, Addy.
No, absolutely, and you really do. It's obvious that you two click, you know, and that she feeds you and you feed her, and there's a nice little example of that called An American French Toast Story on page 63. I would very much like you to read that.
Sure. Yeah. You know, you reminded me of something that someone who you and I both know, G. Murray Thomas, said after when he was reviewing an earlier book, which was also a travel book. He kind of summed it up, the book, as one long love poem to Addy, you know, and I mean, before I read this piece, you know, there's been some critique. Well, you know, you've got 200 pages and there's some longer pieces, but you have so many of these tiny little poems, which are just a single observation and, you know, things like that. And, you know, it's, I guess one of the ways that I would encourage people to look at the book, is as kind of one piece with kind of a through line. You know, there may be certain observations on certain pages, but it's really all about one thing, you know, unlike, say, a selected book where I've taken poems from, you know, different periods of time or whatever, and put them in a book. So you know, I thought G. Murray Thomas kind of summed it up when, you know, he read this 150-page book or whatever it was and regarded it as one long poem for Addy. But that poem, this was written in an amazing little town called Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which isn't famous for anything in particular, but we spent a couple nights there and we loved it. It was beautiful. They have this amazing place called the Strawberry Bank Museum there, which is, again, you know, it's a basically a neighborhood that they restored to, you know, a period time, you know, from a couple hundred years ago, where you walk through it and there's live reenactors who are playing the people who lived in there, and it was a sweet little place. So this was written in a restaurant there called the Friendly Toast, which was pretty cool. You should go eat there. It's called An American French Toast Story. Addy is devastated. She didn't even touch the second piece of French toast at the Friendly Toast. To be fair, they were larger than her head, but she hates to waste food. I try to make her feel better by telling her it's not a big deal. Put it into perspective and think about those poor people who were burned at the stake in Salem, Massachusetts, whose graves we will visit in just a couple of hours. Well, she's forgotten about the French toast anyway.
Again, this poem, I think, for me, has everything. You have Addy as a wonderful character. You have the levity, but you also have that subtext and hitting us with that killer insight at the very end. You know, from a breakfast to French toast. It also makes me hungry, but, you know.
Well, you know, it's no secret why I called my book a couple of books ago, we put things in our mouths. I mean, you know, half of the enjoyment of these trips is finding cool places to eat. You know, I mean, we're not the type to go to. I'm not even going to say a name because I don't want to offend anyone. But yeah. We're not going to show up to just a chain restaurant and eat there. I mean, you know, half the research I do before I go on a trip is, you know, what are the best places to eat brunch, you know, or breakfast or whatever that the locals go to that they rave about. And we have to go to those places. And are there any, you know, unique vegetarian restaurants where vegetarians that we can go and eat in? And, you know, there's a certain euphoria about eating good food, you know, and to do it in a local spot that you can't do anywhere else is awesome.
Yeah, and, you know, French toast the size of someone's head, I mean, that sounds pretty darn awesome right there.
It was really pretty big.
Another thing you do is you do, as you've mentioned already, you visit museums. Are you a very big art aficionado? I mean, are you one of those people that you know what you like, or are you expert on certain artists? You know, you can tell Picasso from Salvador Dali and so forth and so forth.
Well, first of all, no, I'm not an expert by any stretch of the imagination.
Okay.
I will say, you know, to sort of modify one of the choices you gave me, I do know what I like when I see it, you know. But then, you know, there are certain artists that you see that are unmistakably those artists, like Salvador Dali.
Sure.
There's no question that's a Salvador Dali. We were just at the Philadelphia Museum of Art a couple of weeks ago, actually. And I'm sorry, we went to the Barnes Foundation, which is a museum a couple blocks away from there, which was mostly Impressionist painting, all Impressionist paintings, mostly Renoir, and with like 20, 30 paintings on each wall by this very, you know, minute set of artists, Impressionist artists from that time period. And by the end of walking through that museum, I remember being at the Philadelphia Museum of Art the next day and clearly being able to say, oh, well, that must be a Renoir because I saw 300 of those yesterday and that's the same style. So, no, I'm definitely a novice, but you sound more
in tune than I would be. I couldn't tell you what a Renoir looked like.
Well, you know, it's look at the internet, James. It's all there.
Look, Salvador Dali, I probably could figure out. Even though when they think of Salvador Dali, they think of more of his later works, and there's quite a bit of work that doesn't actually look like Salvador Dali. And there's like you, there's a few that are very, very recognizable, Magritte, Salvador Dali, but a lot of those, I can tell you.
Well, a good rule of thumb is, you know, if it has something melting in it, it's probably a Dali.
Well, again, not necessarily if you look at his earlier work. But while we're on the subject of museums, a wonderful piece on page 111 called At the Museum. And I would actually like you to read two poems this time around because I think they're so closely related. At the Museum, page 111, and Paper Zoo, page 112.
Okay. This is, you know, if I, you know, this is one of those things where both of these poems are in different numbered sections, and each section was basically its own kind of observation, which, you know, previously in the book, they might have been their own poem per se, you know, but I thought it might be interesting to kind of combine a lot of these together since they all happened in the same place, even though they're per se about different experiences per se. So At the Museum. This was, by the way, well, actually it reveals it in the first stanza, so never mind. Here we go. One. It cost $27 to valet park your car at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Remind me to never drive my car here from Los Angeles. Two. Addie misreads the coat check sign as goat check. Would have been nice. Three. There are foreigners here. Either that or that is the language indigenous to the MFA bathroom, and I am l'étranger. Four. Addie has a fight with the bathroom sink. She describes the altercation. Apparently the sink won. She refuses to tell me who started it. 5. Old photography captures images of people alive long before anyone today. Took a breath. Captured alive. Forever alive. And then this next piece is Paper Zoo, which is named after the exhibit of the same name in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. 1. I'm sure Picasso's The Toad, 1949, is as attractive to other toads as his women are to us. 2. Strutting Bird, Bertold Loeffler, 1903. Now I know where Travolta got his inspiration. 3. Honolulu, Hawaii, Peacock, by Lee Friedlander, 1977. To take a picture of a peacock in black and white leaves a lot to the imagination, which perhaps is the point. 4. A Lion Emerging from a Cave, James Darnell, 1792. He looks pissed. 5. Trout and Reflection by Neil Welliver, 1980, for Richard Brautigan. I have nothing to say about this etching, except it is, in fact, trout.
And of course, that's a reference to Richard Brautigan's Trout Fishing. And Richard is one of your favorite poets, I believe.
My favorite writer is, period, but Trout Fishing in America was the name of that book, yeah.
Trout Fishing in America.
And he, what's cool about that, you know, one of the reasons that that I find him so inspiring, besides the fact that his writing is so good and, you know, sometimes funny and sometimes deeply tragic, etc., he kind of, you know, redefines what things could be. I mean, you know, sometimes, you know, I'll read a poem that's so short or one word, people will sort of be in shock, like, my God, is that the whole thing? You know, but his book, Trout Fishing in America, is this great example of something that he calls a novel, but when you read it, it's actually, you know, a series of essays that you could very easily, or short stories, I should say, which could very easily be perceived as unrelated, you know?
Yeah.
Different characters, different settings, etc. And so the fact that he, you know, left the lines per se, you know, I found really inspirational in that work in particular, and his novels are really amazing and offbeat and et cetera. So yeah, love Brautigan.
Nice. The other thing that in that piece, the Paper Zoo, one of my favorite all time poets is Robert Wynn. And Robert,
me too.
Yeah, and Robert has a habit of commenting on art, often twisting it in a whole different direction. Even you know, his infamous pieces where he takes a piece of art and has someone that you wouldn't associate with that art, like, you know, David Lynch painting you know, the Sistine Chapel or whatever. Or Dr. Seuss.
I'd like
Seuss.
To see that. You know. Speaking of Dr. Seuss, I don't think we mentioned this, but the reason that we went to the Springfield Museums, which is one of the first, you know, sections of the books, and I guess I read that one piece from it, is because they have that's where Dr. Seuss, Theodore Geisel, was born, and they have this amazing memorial and museum of him, basically. There's larger than life statues of many of the characters from his books.
Oh,
and it's just,
I would love to go there.
It's so cool. It's worth a trip to Springfield.
He's one of my favorites.
On its own.
Yeah, he's one of my favorites. Very man, completely ahead of his time, just like Rod Serling, a humanist. That took fantasy and science fiction to tell cautionary tales. Yeah, I love his work. Let's let's jump the track a little bit. We're gonna go a little further into the book. you might have met possibly the worst waiter in the history of waitering. In a piece called "We Know This Is Wrong," it's on page 182. I found this pretty hilarious, and there's fondue in it.
Yes, this was an experience for sure. page 185. Okay,
is it 185? Oh, sorry.
According to my records, yeah, this was quite an experience. This was the last night of our trip. We had just witnessed this amazing, unique art exhibition in the town of Providence, Rhode Island, called Waterfire, where I don't know that you didn't ask me about this, but I'm going to tell you anyway. there's a river that runs through Providence, Rhode Island, and there's a an artist who envisioned this whole thing where there are permanent fireplaces, kind of floating fireplaces throughout the river. And
wow.
On certain Saturday nights throughout the summer, it's a water fire Saturday night. You go and you sit by the river, and you're not the only one. There's thousands and thousands of people along the banks of the river. And at a particular point, people come along and in boats, with Native American costumes and with twirling fire, and they light all of these fires. It goes over the stretch of a couple miles in the river. And there's music playing, and the music is different every time, and it's programmed by the artist himself. And it was truly an amazing, unique experience to kind of just sit there and watch these fires and listen to this music along this river. So this was written shortly thereafter, it really isn't as spectacular as Waterfire was itself, but we stopped into a fondue spot to have kind of one last, fun thing to do before we headed back to get our kid and go home. But it's called "We Know This Is Wrong." It's amateur night at the fondue place, our waiter's first night. They're running out of fruit, and we're seated next to a portable air conditioning unit. We overhear the waiter at another table tell his patrons, "You don't go under there." Technically, he's right, but what situations have happened to inspire that to be said out loud? He brings us our check just so we would have it. Does that mean we can keep it? We don't have to pay? We put the credit card in the thingy and stick it out as far out over the table as possible. We hope he will see it someday and we can go home. Finally, he arrives, apologizes. He was cleaning. We want him to feel good about his first day and offer jokes about how he'll become sick of fondue. He says he already is, as he started as a busboy and used to sample the chocolates off the tables he cleared. This really is too much information. A couple tables away, one busboy tells another something was stolen from this exact table. We leave their mystery, hoping for a future fondue experience catering to experts like us. We head outside where the fire still burns.
That's nice. Again, you take a situation, or a lot of us have been in this situation, and most of us wouldn't even think about writing it. It's like, oh, we had a bad waiter. We had a bad situation. You take a bad situation, you find the humor in it. And it's a gift you have. It's a gift you have, Mr. Rick Lubert.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry you had to suffer for our enjoyment.
All for the cause.
All for the cause. I haven't mentioned this yet, but throughout the book, there are some wonderful pictures. Did you take those pictures, or did someone else take those pictures? Did Addy take those pictures?
I understand the question. I took all of those pictures except for the ones in which I appear, in which case Addy.
Okay, that makes sense.
Them.
Yeah.
Which is, there's a, each, the book is divided into sections, and there's a section for each city and a section for the museums and, like an on the way section and that kind of thing. So I find it easier to kind of organize books when you have, you know, you have categories to kind of put things into.
Sure.
So you know, there's kind of a designed cover page for each section, and there are pictures from the trip there. Not that I hope don't come off as kind of like, hey, here are pictures from our trip, but you know, are kind of interesting.
They're fun.
You know,
they're fun and interesting. I'm looking at one right now. It's a sign shaped as a sun, and it says "Real People Alive on Stage."
Oh yeah, that was a sign actually that we on our drive back to Allentown, Pennsylvania, we stopped in Coney Island and where we met my wife's brother, and we spent a couple hours with them there, and that was in I guess the freak show. And that was the sign that they had right out front, you know, sword
right.
swallowers and just weird people doing weird things. And so that's
as opposed to dead people on stage.
I said weird people, not dead people.
No, but it says real live people.
Oh, right. Yes.
So it's as opposed to dead people on stage, which were, of course, thrill of the zombie apocalypse aficionados and not too many others. So the entire trip, you started where and you ended up where, trip wise, not, you know, obviously you ended up back home, but trip wise, you started in, was it Allentown or was Allentown?
Well, that's
remember.
Where my wife's parents live. So we tend to start our trips there because they are willing
okay.
to, take our son for the, you know, a week or 10 days and allow us to go away on these other trips. So, we started there. We drove through Springfield, Massachusetts, which is where the Springfield Museums were. And then we ended in Portsmouth, New Hampshire that night for two nights. We, then after that, we went to, through Salem, Massachusetts for a day and into Boston, where we were for four nights, and we were there over the 4th of July, which was awesome. And Boston is a really, really fun city with a lot to do. After Boston, we drove through Plymouth,
wow.
Massachusetts, where we got to see Plymouth Rock. And that was on the way to Providence, Rhode Island, where Waterfire was, and also the Rhode Island School of Design Museum, which was a really amazing museum. And then we went back to Allentown, picked up our kid, and flew home.
Wow. Now, did you stop in Massachusetts at all? I know you mentioned Boston, but wait.
Yeah, three of those cities were in Boston.
Okay.
Plymouth, Boston, and I'm sorry, just the two. No, Salem, too. Sorry, Salem as well. All of those were in Massachusetts.
Okay. And did you see Victor? Did you stop by and say hi to Victor?
No. Victor Infante,
too bad.
Of course, is another poet who you and I both know who lives there. But
great,
you know,
poet,
one of the interesting things that's sort of about these trips, since so much poetry is written, and since when I'm at home, I'm so involved with poetry, you know, I'm constantly leaving to go to a reading and all this. I like to give my wife a break from going to poetry readings and things like
gotcha.
That. So, we tend to just make it, you know, kind of us time, in that sense. But we didn't see any people.
So you don't schedule features or anything when you travel, is what you're saying?
Not typically.
Okay. That's good to know.
I mean, I'd be willing, you know, I suppose, but it's not the focus of the trip. The trip is to have a vacation, you know.
Of all your trips, and you've had many, many different trips to many, many different places, and I encourage people to seek out your books. How many of those books, are they all available except for the Paris is the Cheese?
Mostly. If you go to my website, you can see which ones, all the ones that there are. If you click on the books, poetrysuperhighway.com, that's my website. That's where you can also get a copy of this new book. There's a couple of them that are in print in that I have copies of them to sell, but they're not like up on Amazon. I haven't
right.
done what I've needed to do to make that happen yet. And the only one which is just definitively not available, period, is Paris, It's the Cheese. Yeah.
Okay. Of all these locations that you've gone to, what would you say would be your favorite? And which one would you go back to, if you could?
That's a great question. Paris is certainly my favorite place to go at all times.
Okay.
I mentioned we went to England over winter break because I was invited to a conference there to read poetry and to do workshops and stuff. And because we were there and hadn't been to Paris in a bunch of years, you know, to me it just seemed like we have to go to Paris. We have to go back there, even though we'd been there three previous times. You know, I personally needed to go there and breathe. You know, so that's definitely my favorite place in the world. I'd go back to almost any place because there's really there are places I liked better than other places. I was thinking that about Venice, for example. We went to Paris, Rome, and Venice on our honeymoon, and we liked Venice, and there were some cool things there, and we ate some of the most amazing food that we, ever had. But would we schedule a trip back there? I'm not sure, because it wasn't necessarily our favorite place in the world, and there's so many other places to see. I suppose we would go back just to have that meal that we had there, because it was so good. But, there's no place just about that I wouldn't go back to, but I do have kind of a wanderlust and would like to see lots of new places, too.
True. True. Do you speak French?
Do I speak French? Enough to make the French people think I speak French during the first couple of sentences, and then they start talking back in French, at which point I either respond...
You just say oui,
oui. I respond to them with something that makes sense or not. I took French for a bunch of years in junior high school and high school, so I do okay, better than your average person, I suppose, who doesn't speak French. But, I remember being there on one trip and confusing the words for boat and bottle, and I'm pretty sure I ordered a boat full of water. It's
yeah. I did that in Italy. Because Spanish and Italian are close, but not exactly always synonymous. And I was trying to find a train station, and somebody pointed me to a toy train, a toy store with a toy train in the window.
That's funny.
Not exactly the same thing. Did you have, in terms of respect, did you find that you were respected in Paris just because you tried with your broken French?
Yeah, definitely. I think that the French Parisians in particular get a bad rap. I mean, the stereotype is that they're all rude and et cetera. And I've been to Paris, I think, four times now, and I have never found that to be the case. And maybe it's because I try. I think it kind of butts up against the stereotype of the rude American tourist who speaks louder and slower in English, and who's going to have a friendly experience if you're doing that. I mean, I think if you kind of go any place with humility and try to respect where you are and what you're doing, you're going to, for the most part, have a good experience.
Yeah, I unfortunately I did not. I had a waiter that was even worse than your waiter, and he was the stereotypical, the bad stereotype that you hear about. But at the same time, I knew that maybe I just got unlucky. I know that Derek Brown also had a bad experience there. But
wherever you go, there's nice
people. You're
going to
run into those people. Exactly. I have had bad experience in Mexico. I've had bad experiences here, so it's one of those things. I think it is the luck of the draw, and you can't really blame a whole city. And certainly Paris is a very culturally and very beautiful city. And I know we digressed a little bit.
Sure.
But it's all trips. It's all about trips. Is there any particular moment on this trip that really stood out for you above all others?
I just would have to return to Waterfire. I mean, we had a great trip. We had great food all over the place. We saw fireworks while sitting on the closed highway in Boston on the 4th of July. amazing museums, etc. But there was nothing like Waterfire. It was a really just unique experience in a
yeah.
town which you know, which we enjoy. We probably wouldn't spend too much time in Providence if we were to go back there, because it's a small place, but it's cool. And you know, just being at this live musical fiery art exhibit was you know, was the thing that really stands out on this trip for me. Yeah.
Any tips for future travelers of anywhere?
yeah.
Wow, James. Yeah, where'd that come from?
Make sure you bring your wallet. I'm not sure where to go with it. You know, I just when you go to a city, experience everything that it offers. Like, see their museums, see the unique things that you can't see
That's
anywhere else. You know, get off the beaten path a little bit, but don't shy away from things that are labeled touristy things, because there's a reason why those things are there. You know, I mean, we went to Niagara Falls a while back, and you know, that's one of the number one tourist destinations in the world. And there might be one sensibility that says, oh well, you know, that's just a touristy thing, you shouldn't do that. But the truth is, it's really a spectacular, amazing thing that people
yeah.
should, there's nothing like it. So just be open to seeing things, and you know, having the experience that the city offers.
See, that's good advice, and that's exactly what I was aiming for. So I'm glad you picked up on that. Why don't you send us home? I think we're ready to end your trip with the last exit out of New York. I believe it's page 191.
Sure. The last exit out of New York is Arthur Kill Road. I'm not sure if A, Arthur was killed here, B, Arthur killed the road here somehow, C, Arthur is a killer celebrated by this road for some reason, D, this is where one would go to kill someone named Arthur, and if so, would you have to bring your own Arthur, or would they supply one? In any case, we have just entered New Jersey, where it is not wise to ask questions.
I think Arthur was killed because he knew about the Great Tamale Conspiracy. But we're not supposed to talk about that because, you know, we might get calls.
right.
But again, that's, you know, somebody, just a normal person wouldn't pick up on the stuff that you pick up on. The way your brain works is just, it's just really incredible to me. You know, and we've talked in the past about how you came upon your presentation, you know, the dry humor, the way you present a poem, and you know, it just all works. You have a certain style that it's, speaking of painters that have a certain style, you're basically a word painter that has a certain style, and it's almost instantly recognizable as a Rick Lubert poem. And it's been my great pleasure to be able to talk to you today and to take this journey with you. Is there anything else that you would like to say to the listening public? We have about a minute and a half.
Sure, yeah. I mean, basically, I want to thank you, James, for having this conversation with me and helping delve into the book a lot. I really appreciate it. It's interesting to hear about it from, you know, another person's perspective. You don't necessarily get that when you put your artwork out there, and it's cool to see how you perceive it. I would just really encourage people to check it out, I guess, and you can read some other sample poems that I didn't read during this hour online at my website at poetrysuperhighway.com, and of course you can get a copy of it too, if you, which I highly encourage, and I do readings, workshops, and bar mitzvahs.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Rick Lubert, for being with us today on this very special Poetry Superhighway on Blog Talk Radio. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. Go out there, do something beautiful.